Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, wrap them in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we have a sort of fantasy theme to the show today. Our studio guest is comic manga artist Sonia Leong. We'll also hear from Michael J. Harvey talking about his debut YA novel, Oren Amula, The Call of the Mountains. And the explorer, Matt Dickinson, will be chatting to us about his book for children, Popcorn Eating Squirrels of the World Unite. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Sonia.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us. Now, we've got Michael, who's written a YA novel, and Matt, who's written a children's novel, but comics not just for children and young adults.
Absolutely. I think it's part of a problem that a lot of people sort of experience, in that comics have always traditionally in this country been viewed as something, you know, very, very slapstick and something that's aimed at kind of young. But actually in many other countries and cultures, particularly in France, but also in Japan, which is what my style is, it's very much, you know, it's like talking about TV. Like, TV is a format, like comics and manga are a format. So it's a matter of, is it aimed at children? Is it aimed at grown-ups? Is it aimed at teenagers? You know, you'll get stuff aimed specifically for women or stuff for men, and so on and so forth, and lots of different things. So yeah, it's like comparing Teletubbies and EastEnders. They're not the same, you know. So
well,
so yeah, exactly.
No. And fantasy, are you happy with it being put into that genre?
Oh, well yes, just because there are a lot of stories out there which focus on everything. So yeah, I mean, so there's many different types. So there will be definitely a lot of very well-known series out there about fantasy as well as more contemporary slice of life sort of things. So.
And we'll be talking today about manga, anime and comics. Can you define them, the difference between them? I'm sure whole books have been written about that. But
yeah, I mean, generally speaking, comics are comics, as in pretty much any form of sequential art. From then on, you know, you can break it down into various specific type of formats like comic strips or graphic novels or the sort of like the monthly sort of like floppies that you get. So comics is like an all-encompassing word, if you could say that. Whereas specifically manga refers to the Japanese format of comics. And so there are very specific kind of storytelling techniques and devices used within manga in terms of how the characters are presented, how the speech bubbles are and how the panels are laid out compared to some other types of comics out there. And anime as well is slightly different, as that anime refers to animation. So manga is like the written format that you sort of like read, whereas anime refers to whatever you see on the screen. So that's, yeah, anime, animation. So that's the best way to think about it. Yeah.
Thank you, Sonia. Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Moments Like This by Alison Krauss. Why this one?
This is it's a song which I heard many, many years ago, and it was originally on the soundtrack of the movie Twister, and I really loved that film as well. But for some reason, the lyrics of it just really, really sort of got to me in terms of trying. It's kind of what I try to hold myself to, in that even if the world is just going crazy all around you, just keep that inner calm and push on through, and you'll be fine in the end. That's kind of that inner peace to have.
That's Moments Like This by Alison Krauss, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Sonia Leong. Sonia is a comic book artist specialising in anime manga. Her first graphic novel, Manga Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, was published in 2007. But by then, she was a winner in the first Tokyo Pop Rising Stars of Manga UK and Ireland competition and Neo Magazine's 2005 manga competition. Romeo and Juliet went on to be a winner in the Young Adult Library Services Association Award for Best Books for Young Adults. Since then, her illustrations have appeared in numerous comics, picture books, anthologies and novels, including Tori Amos's comic book Tattoo, which won the Eisner Award, the graphic canon of Crime and Mystery, the video game manga retelling of Assassin's Creed 4 and Doctor Who. And she's company secretary of Sweatshop Studios. Sweatshop Studios, I beg your pardon. A UK comic collaborative and independent publisher. She's also authored numerous instruction books on drawing manga. So, Sonia, we'll be talking about manga, of course, a lot today, but doing the research on you in amidst all that manga and anime, I found a degree in economics and politics from Warwick University.
Yes.
Explain, was that your kind of safety net career?
No. Well, yes. Part of it is that I always joke about having suffered from Chinese parent syndrome. I mean, no, they were nowhere near as bad as some. But shall I say, I was gently encouraged to seek and study something which might be less volatile than a more artistic career. The thing is, in general, a lot of people were saying that. And, you know, there will be some schools that have that sort of culture of, you know, academics over anything else. Just due to a whole bunch of experiences, I thought, okay, let's just play it safe. Let's just do this. So, yep, that's why I have a degree, nothing to do with art whatsoever. I sort of stopped studying art formally in year 9, pretty much, because again, the way how it worked was I had to pick and choose my GCSEs. I couldn't have too many creative subjects because the timetable wouldn't allow it. So I just went on into doing all those things. But no, I kept up music on the side. I kept up drawing on the side. Even one of my final subjects, and when I was at school, was theatre arts and stuff. And then when I went to university, right, it was just straight into
comics. So why? Yeah. Why comics and manga? Why were you drawn to that?
I've always read comics ever since I was young. And this could have been anything, you know, Asterix, Tintin, Archie comics, Garfield comics, you know, the Beano, the Dandy, all of that. And the thing is, I actually grew up partly in Malaysia and partly in Thailand as well. I had an international school upbringing. So I've met with lots and lots of people. We would share like our comic books and stuff like that, you know. So I always grew up reading lots and lots of that sort of stuff. And I always thought it was fun. But I never actually wanted to try making it until I made friends with a Japanese girl. And she lent me some of her comics. And I took a look at this and I thought, oh my goodness, I have never seen comics look this sparkly and beautiful before in my life. This is what I want. This is what I want to make. And so that's kind of why I sort of got drawn into to doing it, just because it looks so nice.
That was it, was it? The actual visual appeal of what you saw.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate like comics and slapstick and gore and stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, I want it, when I came across, well, specifically the genre of shoujo manga, which is manga aimed at young girls. When I came across that particular style with its wispy hair and the sparkles and the gorgeous eyes and the lashes and the curly hair styles and like the emotions on their faces, you know, and just like the subtle cues of sort of like trying to navigate your feelings around other people and so on. It was mature and beautiful at once for me. So I thought that's kind of the feeling I want to give to people when I illustrate or when I draw stories and so on.
And rather in that format, rather than a graphic novel, you wanted that readership.
It's weird to say because graphic novels are very much like manga in general. Manga, when you create comics in manga, they are almost always a full size, like a good chunk of a book. So in my mind, graphic novels and manga are very, very similar. It's just, you know, some of the way how some things are drawn are slightly different in that, you know, manga tends to be more black and white. Graphic novels can be in full color. And there are certain sort of like action sort of things that you might see in manga that you might not see in graphic novels. But yeah, for me, graphic novels is more like the length of it. With manga as well, although they can go on forever, definitely they're always sold as tankobons, or sort of like, you know, collected big volumes. So to me, in my mind, they are like graphic novels anyway. But definitely, yes, long format. That's what I like. I don't really like telling like a single strip or whatever. I can do short stories, but even for me, a short story has to be around about 20 pages or so. So, you know, when I do stuff for my anthologies and so on, you know, then I want to try and hit someone emotionally hard with that one little chapter. But I tell it like a long format sort of story.
So I'm picking the process of putting those stories together, which comes first for you, or is there a coming first? Words, pictures, or do they arrive together?
Okay, it depends on First off, it depends on kind of the length of the book and the story itself. So in my mind, I'm never too far away from thinking, okay, is this going to be a short story? Is this going to be a three-volume series? Is this going to be so on? Because that in turn determines how many characters you can fit in, how many scenes you can do it, you know, how many scene changes there can be. So particularly if I'm working in the realms of like short story format, say I've been invited to take part in an anthology or something, the first thing I need to know is what's my page limit. And then I think, okay, I need to come up with something that hits that punch, you know, just that punch in the guts that people walk away thinking, ooh, okay, that was interesting. So then I will formulate characters and the world to fit that. Sometimes I have a feeling and then it can go either horror or fantasy or like slice of life, but I definitely want a particular thing to happen. But then it's only really in the really long format things where it's at least, you know, it's a full volume, 200 pages plus, and or it's like three volumes plus or so on like that, that I think about more of a world building kind of thing. But for sure, when I'm writing my own things as well as illustrating, because sometimes I'm paired with authors as well, and I do the illustrations for someone who's written the script. But if I'm doing my own thing, definitely the pictures come into my mind first before I start actually writing down particular things.
And you listed there the kind of tropes, if you like, of the manga style, the kind of things we associate with manga. Is there room within that for you to make your mark, to have your style?
Oh, absolutely. Within manga itself, it's a bit weird for someone to think that they all look the same, because every artist will have their own take on something. And within manga, I mentioned one of the categories, which is shoujo manga, which is particularly aimed at young girls, which is done very, very pretty, wispy and beautiful. Then there's shonen manga, which tends to be aimed more at young boys. But to be honest, you know, when I say these categories, it really is just a name for where it goes on the shelf. There are plenty of girls who read boys' comics, and there are plenty of boys who read girls' comics, and so on and so forth. The publisher, it's like the house style of a publisher, if you see what I mean. So, for example, a more shonen style would have thicker lines, more sort of spiky sort of like hairstyles, really exaggerated body types, you know, really clean, sort of punchy kind of like, you know, graphic sort of like art. Whereas, you know, there's also a couple more categories out there, like seinen, aimed at adult men, josei, aimed at adult women. And like the style of josei, for example, is really, really impressionist. Whereas seinen, aimed at adult men, it can either go one of two ways. It can go super realistic with wrinkles and cross-hatching and all of that. Or it can go really, really abstract and just like really bendy and stylish. And so there's a lot of room. There's a lot of room for making your own mark on it, definitely.
And what is your own mark? How would you define your own mark?
Oh, okay. I'm well known for the way I draw hair and eyes. I know that my female characters do have got a certain look to them. That said, you know, a lot of people like the pretty men that I draw, and I you know, that's one of the perks of being an artist. You can draw all the pretty men you want. I think a lot of people associate my stuff with looking very beautiful. There's a very stylish, elegant kind of feel to my work, I think. Also, my stuff tends to be quite clean. So even when I'm sketching and when I do my ink work and when I do my colouring, definitely my colours are known to be very bright as well. In comparison to some other sort of style. So I use a lot of contrast in my work. So, yeah.
And what makes a good story for you? You know, what lifts it from the page? It's a very full genre, isn't it? What makes something extra special for you?
You've got to love the characters. I think...
No different from a prose novel then, in a way.
Yeah, because... it's like, I mean, I could look in a character and go, oh, okay, they look really nice. But if I, in the process of reading it, I just go, oh my gosh, they're absolutely vapid. There's nothing to them. Then I just go, you know, then I lose interest. For me, it's there has to be little quirks to a character that makes you want to go, oh, they're adorable. Oh, I just want to look after them. Oh, please don't let anything bad happen to them. Or, you know, something like that. I like getting emotionally involved. I love the characters out there as well who are just like, yes, be vengeful. You deserve it. Kill everyone. You know, so it's things like that. You know, so definitely I love characters which are flawed. They have to be flawed in some terrible ways. But you still have to love them regardless of them, their flaws. So to me, that's what lifts it. It's like when you fall in love with a character, you just want to follow them and just see what they do.
Oh, well, thank you, Sonia. We'll be talking about some of your characters later, no doubt. But let's hear now from Michael J. Harvey. He's a Master's in Medieval History from Cambridge University. He describes himself as a blogger, adventurer and traveller, or an Amula One. The Call of the Mountain was published last year. And I started by asking Michael to tell me what the novel's about.
Well, I suppose I should start by explaining the name, because it's an unusual name. It's actually in a different language, a language that I've created. It's an Elvish language, and it means literally the Mountain of High Magic. So it's this exotic, mysterious location that used to have a central role in the affairs of the world I've created, Astrom. But it's sort of fallen into silence. The League of Wizardry that was called its home there has fallen from power. They've completely fallen away. So most of the people of the world have forgotten all about it. So it's a tremendous surprise when mysterious invitations start coming out from Kuluthiel, who is the keeper of the mountain, inviting them to a tournament. And no one knows what it's about.
So you've invented a language.
Absolutely.
Where do you start with that?
Well, gosh, I wish I knew more about language. And I wish I'd known more when I started. I literally just started on a word-for-word basis, just trying to find out what different words would be. Unlike Tolkien, unfortunately, I'm not a professional linguist or philologist. But with some perseverance and it built up over time, I managed to give myself a reasonable foundation from which to derive the names of places and characters that had a consistency.
And it sounds Tolkien-esque. Are you a fan?
Oh, absolutely. I've yet to meet a bigger Tolkien fan. I absolutely fell in love with Tolkien's work when I was a boy. I remember vividly reading The Hobbit in my grandma's house, you know, this sort of old wooden-beamed Tudor house, and just reading it by lamplight at night. And I just fell in love with the idea of this world that he's created and wonderful stories. And I remember being incredibly upset when my parents said I was too young to read Lord of the Rings straight away afterwards.
So who is this book aimed at? Do you have an age range in mind?
I suppose it is primarily aimed at adults, but it's certainly appropriate for older teenagers as well, possibly some younger teenagers. There are some more intense passages and there is quite a bit of violence at times, so it's not appropriate for kids. But, you know, when it comes to teenagers, I guess that's down to the individual teenager.
And the world that you create has to be completely convincing, doesn't it? Where do you start with something like that?
I started with a map. I remember one day in school, a particularly boring lunchtime, I had one of those squared A5 notebooks and I just drew a map, just straight off. I mean, I'd been experimenting a little bit before that, but suddenly the shape of this world, Astrom, just came out. And I decided where mountains would be and rivers. And, you know, suddenly I had this incredible epic landscape, which was just going to be a wonderful setting for so many stories. So although I had the germ of several ideas of stories, it was the landscape that came first. And it's the terrain that shapes the events that take place in them.
And while you've got the freedom to create a world from scratch, as it were, it has to have rules and laws.
It's got to be authentic. It sounds strange because it's a make-believe world, but it's got to be believable. So I try and do nothing to break the reader's immersion. It's fine to bend those rules, and there's obviously supernatural elements to it, but it's got to make sense. You know, everything's got to work together. So whether it's the direction of the wind or the ocean currents or the climate in different parts of it, and just trying to give it a believability from what I know about medieval and ancient cultures and civilizations. It should have its own internal logic and integrity.
And it's called Oran Amula 1.
That's right.
Does that mean it's the beginning of a series?
It is indeed. It's the first of three, and there'll be a trilogy, Oran Amula. This first one is called The Call of the Mountain, because this is when the invitations have gone out. The journey's about to start, this great quest of discovery to try and find the long-lost mountain and hopefully reclaim some of that power. The second book is called Rite of Passage. And it's about the struggles that the different characters have to reach the mountain and the adventures they have along the way. The third book then is called Power Unimaginable, which is the prize that's being held out on offer by Kuluthiel and that has everyone up and down the land. Suddenly they're interested. They want to know what this is. The great powers, the ancient weapons of the wizards, perhaps, that everyone thought was long lost. maybe they're coming to light again.
So is it all plotted out? You know the titles? Do you know the plot? How far is it written ahead?
Well, the novel has grown in the telling in many ways. I wrote it first when I was 16 during my GCSEs. Apparently, I didn't have enough to do at the time. And it was relatively short, and it's grown in the telling. And I realised a few years ago that, crikey, if I'm going to get this published, it badly needs a complete rewrite. And in the process, it got longer and longer and longer to the point where it was just too big for a single book. So the publisher took the decision to split it into a trilogy of three.
And this seems to be a growing genre, this fantasy genre. So you need to stand out, don't you?
I certainly hope so. It's a blessing and a curse, I suppose, that fantasy is getting more and more popular. Because on the one hand, more people are aware of it, interested in it. There's many more potential fans out there. But I've also got a perception that there's a lot of good fantasy out there at the moment, increasingly so, in fact. So I know I'm up against stiff competition in terms of standing out and being different from what else has been written.
And why do you think this is a popular genre? Why do people enjoy fantasy so much?
There's something about imagining yourself in a world where anything's possible, where you can get away from the ordinary restraints of life. I love the idea of having my own world to play with. Some people might call it escapism. I don't think of it like that. I just like the possibilities that it offers. Obviously, there's exciting things that go on there. So it's readily understandable on that level, you know, when you've got battles and dragons or whatever else it might be. But I just wonder if there's something, you know, deep down in our psyche somehow that just loves this primordial, you know, sort of ancient stuff. I think back to things I've read in history when we genuinely used to believe in dragons and wizards and fairies and everything. And science has disproven all that now, but I just wonder if deep down there's still a longing for that stuff somewhere that's just awakened by a good story.
Some fantasy writers use their world and the characters in it as metaphors for the real world. Have you done that?
Certainly not consciously. We're all shaped by our times and the times we live in, but I've made no conscious effort to say anything about the current world. There's no hidden political message in the works. I share that dislike of allegory that Tolkien had.
And what's next for you? I mean, you've got these three to write, and then do you have ideas for further novels?
Absolutely.
Well, two more to write. You've already written one.
Two more to write, or at least to finish writing and finish polishing off. The sequel is already written, but like the first one, it was written a long time ago, and it badly needs a rewrite. That one, believe it or not, is actually nearly as long as The Lord of the Rings. So it's a huge and daunting project. So while I hope this novel does really well, I hope that I don't have too many fans with too big a gap before the sequel can come out. The sequel may well be called Starbane, and it's the events following on from Auron Amular.
Same characters?
It's a lot of the same characters. Some come and go. That it's basically, once we get past Auron Amular, we broaden out. You start to see a lot more of Astrom, different places, different characters. Just the canvas will expand hugely. So it's a daunting project, and equally daunting is the fact that I think I'd like to write at least 60 different novels. I was trying to plan out, just, okay, so if I'm going to write these, how long do I need? Crumbs, I better get started now. So.
And Lord of the Rings, you mentioned that earlier. Other favourite novels in that genre?
In the fantasy genre, I love the works of David Gemmell. I'm reading Brandon Sanderson, his Mistborn trilogy. Huge fan of Game of Thrones. And I'm frustrated like everyone else that the latest books are taking so long to come out. I like other stuff too, particularly historical fiction, which, bizarrely enough, I've never ever had the compulsion to write, but I love reading it. So I'll lap up anything by Bernard Cornwell or C.J. Sampson.
And Auron Amular 1, The Call of the Mountain by Michael J. Harvey is published by Malcolm Down Publishing. Listening to that with me as our studio guest on Bookmark today, Sonia Leong, a comic anime and manga artist. Sonia, Michael talking there about world building. World building's very appropriate in your format as well. Where do you start?
He mentioned something about starting off with a map. And yeah, and listening to his experiences, I was like, oh my God, this sounds like me. Because yeah, one of my latest fantasy graphic novels. It's not so much a graphic novel, it's a light novel. And it's a format where you write it in prose, but you write it with specifically with a lot of action, a lot of dialogue, so the sentences are short, the paragraphs are short, and it's punctuated with illustrations. So it's like a picture book, but for teenagers and for grown-ups, really. I wrote that story. I first started writing that story when I was 14, and gosh, I had to change a hell of a lot of it. Yeah, so I remember starting off with that map. Definitely having a map is so useful because now then you have in your mind, it determines everything, because if your characters go on a journey, and you can bet in fantasy they will go on a journey, you need to think, wait, how long is it going to take them? What mode of transport are they going to use? Are they, you know, is it going to take them 3 days? Is it going to take them a month? In which case, you've got to write stuff to fill that. You know, so having that map definitely puts it all and makes it much more real. And then, but then also it just allows the reader to sort of keep track of things a little bit more as well, so that it sort of matches up in their mind. So definitely having that map is a big thing, but also rules and making sure that everything kind of works. Like I have a, for one of my books. So this is for my book A Brush with Magic. And that one, there is magic in that world. But the way how I tried to sort of like justify that was that magic users can see something that others can't, and then they weave the threads of magic that are in the air in order to create magic spells. And so in that's the reason why some people can do it and some people can't, because some people have a spectrum where they can see that sort of thing and actually make magic from it. And so it's you, but then you have to work within that, and there are limitations. You use up all the threads that are currently there, you can't do anything for a little while, and so on and so forth. So yeah, rules and a map. Gosh, it sounds so like logical.
And Michael listing his influences there at the end. Who are your influences?
Well, he mentioned a couple that David Gemmell I read, yeah, and McCaffrey. I loved all of the Dragon Riders of Pern sort of things. I had a major crush on Master Robin, you know, Master Robinton. I had a major crush on him. But crushing on characters. My gosh, you know. Okay, so I have this really, really like guilty pleasure love of like Anne Bishop's Dark Jewels sort of stuff. So it's again, there is magic involved. There's lots of sexy men involved as well. And so yeah, it's sort of dark fantasy kind of stuff. I read quite a few of these things. I mean, Tolkien is obviously one that I read as well. And yeah, you know, elves, love elves and things. Elves, dwarves, I love the way they hate each other. So again, it's seeing that dynamic between people, and I like seeing the relationships between people like that, and different races as well.
Well, thank you, Sonia. We'll come back to the sexy men, definitely. I'm not going to leave them. Let's see your second choice of music now, though, that before then. This is From the Ashes by In This Moment. Why this one?
Well, you know how I was talking about, yes, feel the rage burn through you and so on? I just, I have this thing about angry women, and I love it. And I think that more of us should get angry about things. And so I love listening to this band when I just want to just crack on and just go, yes, you know, go on, yes, you know, just do it, you know. So yeah, this is one of those things which is supposed to help you sort of like power on through and make you think, yes, you will survive anything, you are stronger than anything out there.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio
with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspiration.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Sonia Leong, comic, manga and anime artist. Before the music, Sonia, which certainly blew a few cobwebs away, I think, we were talking about sexy men. What role does sex play in manga? Because a couple of times you talked about people fancying the characters or making the characters look a certain way. Mm-hmm. Eroticism and sex, what role do they play?
Well, definitely sex is not shied away from in manga, because like I said before, particularly that sort of style of comicking, there's you know, there are comics made specifically for adults as well. Certainly, a lot of it is to gather fan support. So we use the term fan service when we draw something that's meant to titillate audiences, and it's specifically like, here's a present for you, and then just go, yes, give me more, you know. So it's indulgent. So you will get a lot of that in terms of sort of like, you know, making sales or just like building up that sort of like fan support for it. You will see it in a lot of books. But in my work, I don't do so much of it, simply because a lot of my a lot of my stuff is aimed more at the sort of teenage market. So there are certain, obviously, I need to think about sort of age ratings and so on. And the thing is, once you illustrate something, then it's held to a much sort of rigorous, much more rigorous standards than if you just write something in prose. You know, so it's...
What do you mean?
As in, if you go into any bookstore here and you pick up any manga book... responsible publishers should have an age rating on the back, because just because the characters on the front cover look super cutesy doesn't mean they're not going to take all their clothes off inside. So you need to watch out for that, because I mean the style of manga, when you draw characters, they often can look very, very cute and very sort of like charming and disarming. But just because they're cute doesn't mean that it might not be that you know, it's aimed at kids. So that's what I mean in terms of you have to sort of be a bit more careful about that. So I mean, it's like when you write about, for example, a sex scene, it's kind of different to when you illustrate it, you know, because then if you illustrate it, that becomes much more explicit. And so that's why I do have to watch kind of like, you know, what I do in my books to make sure that, you know, this is appropriate for this age, this is appropriate for that age. Because I do a lot of comic cons, I do a lot of events, and yeah, you know, I'm always sort of watching just to make sure. It's like, how old are you? No, put that one down. You know, so yeah.
Is it a changing art form then, manga? Has it changed since its beginnings? I mean, when did it first begin?
Oh gosh, okay. So many people credit Osamu Tezuka as being the main sort of like forerunner of the modern manga format as it is today, because he pioneered this sort of style of cinematic kind of comicking. You see, when you think of a typical comic strip, you think of a few boxes in a row, and you'll see the characters. They might and they have the speech bubbles above them, and you know they're interacting in some way across those strips. Now, Osamu Tezuka, he sort of blew that out of the water, and he's well known for Astro Boy and
what kind of period are we talking?
Yeah, so here? Oh, like 50s, that sort of thing. He would sort of like you'd go from an extreme close up of the eyes, and then suddenly the next panel the camera would sort of pan all the way back, and you see this really far distant shot, someone shooting through the sky. Then it might be a really low angle shot, and then it might be like, you know, a mid sort of shot or a two shot where two people are like side on, you know. So the best way for me to describe it is like, imagine you're directing a film and you're cutting from one camera to another camera to another camera. It's like that, and that definitely is a hallmark of the manga sort of style of formatting and layout. And the thing is, in manga as well, we change the shape and size of the panels to suit what sort of like fits what you're telling inside, but also you control the pacing. So smaller panels, readers will go through faster. Big panels, they'll stop and take a long look. So you use the big panels for when you want to show something is taking long to happen, like somebody's taking a long time to get up, or you know, it's a moment of importance where like the two warring sides shake hands. Then you have a really big panel for that. So there's a lot of control in terms of, you know, I'm guiding the reader. You know, I want you to read this bit fast. No, I want you to take your time over this bit, and so on. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it started. But obviously, over the decades, just like fashion, there'll be changes in terms of like what things are popular. So I mean, in the 50s and 60s, I think the characters were much more sort of cutesy and more rounded. In the 70s, the manga had really super big hair. 70s and 80s had really, really big hair. You know, so it's kind of like that. You know, it changes with fashion. At the moment, I think definitely over the past sort of like 10, 20 years, it's more, I think people are more happy about, say, maybe less is more. I think so. So people are pulling back a little bit from going way too overboard with sparkles and so on, but they are more willing to put down some more black fills or just go for something that's just a little bit more sort of like reserved but stylish. I think part of what marks a professional out is definitely knowing when to stop. And so you can see some of the more modern sort of series coming out. There's a good artist knows when to pull back and make it a bit more simpler rather than try and jam it full of too much detail. So that I think that's what's going on at the moment.
Thank you, Sonia. We'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's take a break now to hear from Matt Dickinson. He's a writer and filmmaker. He's worked as a director and camera operator for the Discovery Channel, the BBC and Channel 4. He has a passion for climbing mountains, and his films and writing reflect this. In fact, he's one of the few British filmmakers to return alive from the summit of Mount Everest. The subsequent film, Summit Fever, has been seen by over 20 million people worldwide. And Death Zone, his written account of the expedition, has been published in more than 15 countries. He's also written for young adults, and his trilogy, The Everest Files, has sold almost 20,000 copies. But he joined me to talk about his new venture, a book for younger readers, Popcorn Eating Squirrels of the World Unite. But before we started talking about popcorn eating squirrels, I asked him to tell me about his time as writer in residence on Mount Everest.
That invitation to go to Everest came out of the blue about 2 years ago. Wonderful moment when I saw the email coming in, and it was a tour operator who specialised in taking people on expeditions to Everest and to the summit of Everest, asking me if I wanted to be the writer in residence at base camp, which seemed to me to be a too good an offer, so I just couldn't refuse.
So what did you do as writer in residence on Everest?
What I did was I joined the expedition, which had five climbing team members. I'm also a climber and have previously been to the summit of Everest, so I think that was obviously the reason why they wanted me there. I basically went out with them and spent a month at base camp and up to two of the higher camps, joining the team and writing about it for The Telegraph and for The Guardian and with a blog site as well.
And looking at your CV, it is littered with mountains that you have climbed. What is it about climbing mountains?
Well, that was a childhood fascination. I started reading about mountains when I must have been about 12 or 13 years old. I went to school in Hemel Hempstead, and there were loads of books in the library at my school which were about climbing. So I began as a reader, got inspired by the idea of Everest and K2 and these other mountains, and I started to think, well, maybe I could do those things. So I went off to the Peak District and to Scotland when I was about 16, 17 years old, and that's where my interest in mountains began.
And you've written about Everest in particular.
I have written many times about Everest. It's a fascinating subject. It's a mountain that's never the same place twice. It changes its identity, and the issues that surround it and the problems that it throws up are constantly changing and ever fascinating. I've written several books. I've written one piece of non-fiction, which was the first book I wrote. It's called The Death Zone, and that was the story of climbing the north face of Everest, where we went with Brian Blessed to make a film. And
there's a book in that, isn't
there? There was, yeah, absolutely. There's a lifetime's experiences in that particular expedition. Then I've written several pieces of fiction which have featured Everest, including my series for teenage readers, which is called The Everest Files.
And you've got these books now about squirrels, popcorn and squirrels. So a bit of a change from Everest.
You know, I've got five children, and I always loved that stage of a child's life when they're sort of, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, and they discover reading for themselves and discover how exciting reading can be. I went through that as a child. I loved reading, and reading very adventurously. And I've always encouraged my own children to read. And as a writer, I like to do different things and keep myself interested. So I thought, well, let's have a go at writing a series for primary age. And that's when I came up with the Popcorn Eating Squirrels. The most recent book is Popcorn Eating Squirrels. Surprise, surprise, go nuts on Everest.
You say you came up with the idea of popcorn eating squirrels. How on earth did that happen?
That happened because my daughter had a birthday party. When she has a party, she creates an awful mess in the garden. They went out in the garden and they were messing around. There were fizzy drink bottles and spilled crisps. And on top of the bike shed, there was a bunch of popcorn that had been spilled, salted caramel flavoured popcorn. I was just watching, feeling a bit, you know, miffed that she'd made such a mess. And then this squirrel came down and started sniffing around and started eating the popcorn. And that's when I thought, oh, look at that, the popcorn eating squirrels. And that's where it began.
And it looks like you have a lot of fun reading these books. They're very vivacious and lively, and the fun that you have writing them comes through.
Yeah, the same is true of any author. You know, if you enjoy your work and you get a challenge from it and you enjoy the variety of being a writer, and particularly if you can employ humour and you enjoy doing that, I think it's great fun. There's nothing better than writing a book that you've enjoyed writing and then getting the feedback from readers who've also enjoyed reading it.
And how closely do you work with the illustrator?
Very closely. So the illustrator of these books is a remarkable and very talented person. His name is Calloway Berkeley O'Reilly. He's 19, or I think he might be 20 years old now. He is a very, very impressive illustrator. He's the son of an illustrator, so I think he's kind of picked it up through those years of watching his father work, but he's also got bundles of natural talent. I think his pictures are really, really fun. They capture the characters really, really well.
And how many more books are there in the Popcorn Eating Squirrels series to come, do you think?
Who knows? I mean, I'm up for as far as the journey goes. I mean, we're going to do three, definitely. The next one is Popcorn Eating Squirrels Go Nuts with the Dinosaurs. I finished that. That was this summer I wrote that, so that's coming out next summer. Then after that, I went to a primary school last couple of days and road tested a few ideas, and the one they liked best was the popcorn eating squirrels go nuts in space. So I think the squirrels might get sucked into a black hole at some point in the not too distant future.
Oh, you road test them with potential readers?
Yeah, that must be
fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I do loads of school visits. I do about 100 schools a year. And when I get an opportunity to do a bit of kind of focus group stuff, you know, if I get a class of kids, I'll ask them, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And try ideas on them. And in a way, that's where I got the confidence to write the popcorn eating squirrels, because when I road tested that, the reaction was better than anything I'd ever mentioned to children before. Just the title alone was like they were completely fascinated by it. So that's when I really thought, oh, it could be that they'll want to read it. So that was where it began.
It's a very visual idea. It'd be great for a cartoon or a film.
Yeah, it'd be lovely to make it into a cartoon series. It really would.
And what about the two sides of your life then? How do they work? Are you still doing the mountain climbing?
I love the mountains and enjoy climbing. I have been twice to Everest in the last 3 years. Yeah, I love that side of things. I'm doing less filmmaking these days because the writing is really taking over. I'm happy with that because the filmmaking in the mountains is very demanding physically and it's kind of a young man's game. So I think at the moment I'm enjoying the writing, I'm enjoying learning the trade of being a writer and enjoying the unexpected things that happen with it as well.
And do you see yourself stepping into the world of adult fiction, writing a novel?
I would like to write a crime thriller. I've been thinking about that and gently mulling over a couple of storylines, which I think could work. So, yeah, I definitely would like to write for adults. I think it would be a crime series if I did that.
I wonder how it would compare to writing for the age group that you're writing with the popcorn-eating squirrels, which is roughly what age group is it?
6 to 9.
Quite challenging in terms of what language you choose to use.
Yeah, any primary school teacher picking these up will recognise that popcorn-eating squirrels is quite a challenging read for young readers. And I make no excuses for that because that's what I wanted it to be. So it's by no means dumbing it down. And I think it's really good to challenge young readers with their vocabulary and every aspect of how they read. I think when you write for adults, there's no limits to where the story can go. You're driving with the brakes very much off when you're driving. Whereas when you write for young readers, you constantly have to be aware of the fact that the themes and the dialogue and everything that you're doing has to be appropriate for that age group.
And it has to end well, or at least it has to end with a moral to the story.
Yeah, there's normally a moral in the story, particularly with picture books. Yeah, definitely. Which I've never written a picture book for extremely young readers. I'd love to. But with these type of illustrated adventure stories for 7, 8, 9-year-olds, yes, there is a moral of the story, but mostly it's about the characterisation and the fun of the journey, I think.
And was there a book that you remember reading when you were growing up that really captured your imagination?
Well, there have been many, many. I mean, when I was young, obviously, I loved adventure books. That was where my journey began. I loved the books of Arthur Ransom, for example. Swallows and Amazons, I think, would be a very much a key book of my childhood. And the Willard Price adventure series, which I'm sure many of your listeners will fondly remember. So, yeah, loads of reading as a young boy and often about adventure.
And how do you feel about popcorn these days? Now you write about it all the time. Can you actually face it and eat any of it?
My problem with all these things is when I start eating them, I can't stop. So I can't really start because literally a bowl of popcorn, I will eat it until it's all gone.
Well, so it's research, isn't it?
It could be a dustbin full of popcorn. I'd still eat it. It's research, I guess, yeah.
And Popcorn Eating Squirrels of the World Unite by Matt Dickinson is published by Vertebrate Digital. Listening to that with me was Sonia Leong, our studio guest on Bookmark today. She's a comic, manga, anime artist, and you can find out more about her work on her website, firedrake.net, firedrake.net. Listening to that, Sonia, I was wondering what was going through your mind. Were you seeing it in a manga way? Is that how your mind works now when you hear a story, you think how it would look in a manga?
Well, right. I was glad to hear that he also has had to do a lot of like school visits and stuff. Because yeah, hearing about that, I actually do a lot of school visits myself because it's very hard to get teenagers engaged in a lot of reading. That's what a lot of schools tell me. They often have very many illustrators come in for the younger age groups, but it's hard to get teenagers enthusiastic about anything. Sometimes they say so. When they find out, it's like, she does manga. And then they go, wait, manga, that stuff, they like that stuff. They read that stuff all the time. We can't stop them reading it. So I frequently do a lot of school visits. And yeah, hearing about sort of like, what sort of stuff is appropriate for a kid and, what sort of, can they deal with that sort of thing? It just makes me think, oh gosh, I have to do that a lot whenever I'm teaching because there'll be some things, when I teach, I just don't dumb things down, I try my best to sort of like present it in a format they would understand, but I would never dumb something down. So a lot of my books that are aimed at children, or aimed as an educational tool. So my manga Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet was very is definitely in the that education market. But one of the books that I made recently that came out only last year was it's a graphic novel sort of biography of Marie Curie, and again that's also aimed at sort of educational markets of 9 to 12 and so on. It's sort of like, you know, if you've read up about Marie Curie's life, you know that she was not short of scandal. She was an amazing woman, and yes, she had some scandal. But just because one has a little bit of scandal doesn't mean that a Nobel Prize should be like denied her. You know, so we didn't shy away from an affair. We didn't shy away from that sort of thing. You know, it's just it's good to be able to sort of present it that way, and also. Even in my Romeo and Juliet, it's like, yes, spoilers, they die. It's so sad, they die. And yeah, I drew that, yeah. So, yeah, that was what I took.
It's been brilliant talking to you today, Sonia, feeling your enthusiasm and passion. It's just been wonderful. I'll finish by asking you a question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark. What are you reading at the moment?
Okay, so I'm reading this comic. It's originally in Japanese, so it's a manga, but it's not available in English. The closest equivalent I could get was French, because I speak a bit of French as well. So I bought the French version of it so I could understand it, because my Japanese is good, but my Japanese is not as good as my French. So I bought the French translation of it. It's called Le Gourmet Solitaire, or in Japanese, Kodoku no Gourmet, or The Solitary Gourmet. And it actually came out years and years ago, but it's been made into a live action series, and it's been running for about 8 seasons now. It's about this salesman called Inogashira. He deals with sort of like importing, exporting antiques and stuff from Europe into Japan. And he travels around, he does his client meetings, but then he always gets hungry at some point. And so he has to seek out something to eat. He will go somewhere, and then, you know, he will, in his mind, he goes, yes, you know, well, how am I going to formulate this menu? Let's start off with a little bit of like this sort of starter, and we have to pair it. We have to have a meat. We have to have fish. We have to finish off with some rice. Yes, the perfect thing for like a sumo wrestler, like win finish. So he uses a lot of baseball puns. He uses a lot of sumo wrestling puns and so on. But yeah, he just likes going out to eat by himself after his sales visit. So I'm hugely enthusiastic about food, you know, so seeing all the illustrations of food, but also seeing his sort of like eyes light up when it's like, oh yes, this fried rice is so good, you know. So it's a book about this guy who just goes out and eats by himself and enjoys it.
You sold it to me. It's got food in it. Thank you, Sonia. We'll come back to you for your last choice of music in just a moment, but a heads up that our next show, the studio guest, is Guinevere Glassford, talking about her novel The Year Without Summer, which is about lives connected by the eruption of a volcano in Indonesia in 1815. We'll also hear from Anna Hope on her novel Expectation, and Sir Christopher Andrew, former librarian and archivist of MI5, talks about his most recent book, The Secret World, A History of Intelligence. But we'll finish now with your last choice of music, Sonia, which is Pop Stars by KDA. Why this one?
Okay, this is going to be a bit of an interesting one. KDA does not exist in reality. KDA is a girl group made up of 4 video game characters, and it's from the video game League of Legends. It was part of sort of like an opening sort of ceremony song, and they got actual pop singers together. I mean, particularly quite well known in Korea, all together to actually make it. So it's just a really it's just a high energy kick ass song, and the good thing about it is I like listening to stuff in Korean, because although I speak a bit of Japanese, I don't speak any Korean, so when I listen to it I don't get distracted by lyrics when I work. This one does have some English though, so you'll be able to hear some of it, but yeah, just enjoy some really good energy and just strong women.
Cambridge 105 Radio.